This, then, is the last seminar in the series of seminars on the future, devoted to the subject of the future of politics. All along, I've been emphasizing a particular point, which is this, that the very idea of the future has something spurious in it. That to live for the future is an indefinite postponement of life. And that the great political systems of the Western world, whether they be capitalist or communist, are based on the notion that what we live for is the future. And this is a very funny thing, especially when you think about Marxism, because the Marxists have always said that religion is the opium of the people, because it's based on the idea of pie in the sky when you die. But in fact, the politics of Marxism are just as much pie in the sky. It's always a five-year plan for something to turn up that will be better than what we have now later on. And in exactly the same way, our notions of the great society are based on a futurist approach to life, wherein you go through in your education a whole series of steps. The word in Latin, gradus, means a step. So we have first grade, second grade, third grade, gradus, gradus, gradus. Finally become a graduate. You know, you've gone along the steps. But you're still doing it. So that when you become finally successful as the president of your corporation, you have a funny feeling of being cheated. You've climbed the stairway and you've got to the top. And there's nowhere else to go. And since you've never been taught to live in the present, you don't know how to. So an insurance salesman comes around and says, listen, I've got the very thing for you, a retirement program, because when you're 65, you'll drop out of the system. And then you'll really be able to enjoy yourself, see, despite your prostate trouble, menopause, false teeth, and everything else. And so the art of living in the eternal now is not taught in our educational system. And it's not taught because it's thought of as being feckless, irresponsible. It isn't irresponsible at all. It is everybody's duty, I could put it that way, to enjoy themselves. Because if you don't do that, you become a nuisance. You become aggressive, you become a robber, you become a thief, you become somebody who's trying to organize the rest of the world, that is to say, a power maniac, simply because you haven't learned the very simple, inexpensive art of living in the present moment. It really doesn't take an awful lot of energy to maintain a human life. If you really consider what you need to eat, what you need to wear, how much housing you have to have, it comes down to something quite simple. And the simpler, the more you have the capacity to enjoy watching a raindrop crawl down a window. But if you watch a raindrop crawl down a window and you think, my, look at that, everybody says, you're crazy. But you're watching a raindrop fall down a window. Can't you find something more important to do? That means, can't you make more trouble than that? So, the mentality that doesn't recognize the importance of watching a raindrop crawl down a window is the one that is creating the trouble in the world today. I had an astounding session just a day or two ago with the chief of an Indian tribe. He was from the Western Shoshone Indians, which are located roughly around central Nevada. And he was explaining how the government of the United States is really seriously trying to get rid of the Indian way of life completely, especially by virtue of a bill which allows the Indians to borrow money on their own land. You know what the end of that's going to be. So, when he had told his story, I said, well, now, what do you want us to do about it? He said, that's the wrong question. I knew this was coming. He said, you pale faces, you white people, you always think about doing something. That means in voting, in politicking. But that's what's the matter with you. So I said, yeah, that's what's the matter with us. He said, we're going to do something about it, but we're not going to do it in your terms. We expect you to be sensible enough to correct your own actions. We're not going to fight you in the ordinary way, not on your terms. He said then further, we are in harmony with the physical earth and geography and the sky and the waters of this country. And you will strangely find that there are going to be more and more tornadoes, more and more earthquakes, more and more natural disasters. Because you are, as people, you are violating nature. You are destroying it, and it will fight back against you. And we are nature. We are not some strangers on this land. We are the same thing as, we're the same process as the land. And we regard ourselves as the same as the continent. And it's not just us in North America. We're in touch with the Indians in Peru, in Chile, Brazil. And we're one great family, and we're just waiting for you invaders from the West, from Europe, to strangle yourselves and get rid of yourselves. But in other words, he was saying that he wouldn't play the political game, not on any account, and didn't really want us to play a political game on their behalf. Now, this is something so inconceivable to most white people, because, for example, when you get Indians on a reservation and they don't do anything and they don't develop it and they just sit around, and we say, well, they're no good. They're just lazy. They cannot make us understand the importance of a contemplative life. We say, you are of no value, you're not even human, unless you're changing things, unless you're interfering, unless you're progressing, unless you are, we confuse growing with progressing, unless something is happening, a great operation, a new project is going on, and you're busy with it, we say, well, you're lazy, you're good for nothing, because you are not working for the future. But they say, if you're working for the future, you're quite mad. So they don't work for the future. Just like a Chinese coolie works long enough to make some money. Then he knocks off work and he goes to the gambling joint. And he gambles. Or he smokes opium. Or just generally wanders around and digs the scene. And we say, well, that's awful. That's irresponsible. You can't do that. That's not maintaining the world properly. What do you think? Maybe that is maintaining the world properly. Maybe it's we who think that everything should be progressing who are destroying the world. Of course we are. By our Protestant ethic, by our notion of keeping everything in charge, it's true. We have a great initial success. We destroy diseases. We keep people alive. But on the end is the H-bomb, to get rid of it all entirely. So these non-political people are saying to us, the trouble with you is you don't know what you want. You have a future which you're working for, but you're all wretch and no vomit. You promised yourselves that a good thing is going to happen. You keep promising, 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 promising. Even your money is a promise. It says on the dollar bill that the Treasury of the United States will promise to pay a dollar. What are you going to get if you deliver this and say, come on now, I want whatever it is that this dollar is. And they just can give you credit. Because it's paper, it's all symbolism. So, all these myriads of so-called primitive people, like Amerindians, Mexican Indians, Africans, don't communicate with us, and we don't communicate with them, because they don't want what we think is the desirable good society. Well, some of them do, of course. So in Japan, for example, the Japanese have been thoroughly conned into the idea that the Western way of life is a great thing. And so they are, by and large, frantic industrialists. And so, as a result, the cities of Nara, Osaka, Kobe are covered in smog. Tokyo is just a madhouse. They're getting it. So the whole point is, the future is an illusion. The basic ideas in Hindu cosmology, that in the course of time, you go through the series of yugas, or the epochs, and you begin with a great state of affairs, and it gradually deteriorates, is a way of saying to people, in the course of time, things only fall apart. Therefore, get out of time. Get off the wheel of samsara, the rat race. And so this underlies my idea of what I call the politics of diversion. Divert Western man from history, from the notion that he is in a historical process which is leading to something always better and better and better, but which in fact only leads to more and more destruction. Divert people from time by living a style of life which is timeless and which is therefore more attractive than life devoted to time. That doesn't exclude our technological power. Part of the whole point of technology that I'm going to take up in detail in a later session, is that through technology, we have the power to obliterate poverty completely. But this must not be looked at in a historical way. While it is looked at in a historical way, it will not work. That is to say, the whole problem of money and the distribution of the wealth of the world as produced by technology is a psychological problem and not a material problem. People are hypnotized with money, which is the symbol of wealth, as if it were something that was valuable in its own right. That's the confusing money with gold. When Ramakrishna said that one of the evils of the world was gold, he was, I think, perhaps unconsciously quite correct. There's a story that once upon a time, all the banks in the world got tired of shipping gold from country to country. And so they decided to open an office in an island in the Pacific where all the banks had their headquarters and all the gold was put together there so that all they needed to do when they had to exchange some gold was to trundle it across the street. And operations proceeded beautifully for about 10 years. And then all the heads of the banks from the different countries came with their wives and their children to visit the island and have a great convention. And so they inspected the books and the transactions and everything was in perfect order. At last, the children said, "Daddy, want to see the gold?" And so the bank president said to the managers, "Take our children down to the vaults so that they could see the gold." And so all those managers said, it's sort of difficult and a little problematic and it takes a lot of time. And the president said, "Well, don't be stupid. What's the matter? Can't they see the gold?" So they hummed and hawed and said, "Well, we're sorry to report that 7 years ago there was a disastrous subterranean earthquake and all the gold was swallowed up. But of course, we all knew how much we had at that time, and so we've kept the books accordingly." So it's a joke. People don't realize, in other words, that that money is bookkeeping. Nothing but bookkeeping. And therefore, the whole idea of taxation, for example, is a complete anachronism. The thing that is stopping the flow of the actual wealth of the world is this fixation on money. What you need to do is actually reverse taxation and issue, instead of charging taxes, issue credit. Then, but you have to keep the credit balanced to the gross national product in some form of figuring, and then everybody can circulate what they're making. Otherwise, you're in this ridiculous situation where people are starving in India and we are hoarding food supplies and burning them and trying dumping them in the ocean, which is sheer insanity. But it's all based on a psychological block about money. So, this kind of psychological block is what in Indian philosophy would be called a maya. It is an illusion. And it's the same kind of illusion as that of the future, of the idea that the future is when we are really going to live. And if that's the way you operate, when you get there, you're never going to be able to handle it because you still want a future ahead of you. You're a perpetual donkey with a carrot suspended from your collar on a rod like this, and you're pursuing it. Well, now, when we approach the subject of politics, you obviously recognize at once that the word is connected to the Greek polis, meaning a city. And the city, as I've indicated in a former lecture, is probably an ephemeral phenomenon in human life. as our technology of communication develops, cities are going to disappear. And for the same reason, as our technology develops, politics are going to disappear. Let's go back to an early stage of our development when human beings changed from being hunters to being farmers. This is a very critical stage in the history of technology. When we were hunters, every male knew the whole culture. In other words, he had to fend for himself, to make his own clothes, to make his weapons, to know the arts of hunting, and also he was in charge of his own religion. There were peculiarly religious people in hunting cultures, and they are called shamans, or medicine men. And the interesting thing about a medicine man, as distinct from a priest, is that he is not ordained by anybody else. He doesn't have to be approved by a guru or by an organization or a church. He goes away alone into the forest and gets his own thing. He may contact what he calls the ancestors, but he has to do it by himself. Now, when a community settles, and instead of being a roving hunting people living in the forests, and they form instead a village, a great change occurs. Where do villages and towns occur? Where a road crosses a river, or a road crosses a road. And then around that, which were originally hunting tracks, trails, a stockade is built. And that is called the pale. We say a person is beyond the pale. That means he's an outsider. Because the pale, from the palus, the tree, is the posts used to make the stockade. So inside the stockade, there are four divisions, four blocks of town. And it is of the essence of an agricultural, as distinct from a hunting culture, that you specialize, that you divide labor. And so when labor divides itself, it tends to divide into four major groups. Those, first of all, who are the brains, the Brahmins, the idea people, the thinkers. Second, the brawn, the military men, who defend the scene. So they are called in India the Kshatriya. Who next? Why, the traders, the merchants, the Vaishya. And then next, who? The craftsmen, the skilled workers, Shudra. Of course, then outside, there are the people who don't have any particular qualifications, and they're the lower outcasts, who are untouchable. But there are another group who are very curious. They're also outside the pale, but they are respected for being outside the pale. And they are called in Sanskrit, Shramana, which is the same as the word shaman. Or in Chinese, Xiaman, meaning an immortal who lives alone in the mountains. In other words, the people who still retain the values of the hunting culture. And say, like this, when you settle down in the city, in the polis, and you divide labor, and you're tinker, tailor, soldier, sailor, rich man, poor man, beggar man, thief, You assume roles. You put on a mask and say, I'm a soldier. I'm a priest. But you get more masky than that. You say, I'm a person. The word person means mask. Persona. The mask worn by actors in the Greco-Roman drama. And you are taught, while you live in the polis, that you are your mask. I was taught by my mother that I was Alan Watts, and I've never been able to recover from it completely. And so everybody is assigned this role that you're supposed to play. Well, you play that role, but in ancient Indian custom, it was recognized that that you played it only for a while. That when you had raised your children and done your social duties, that you then had to prepare for death. Death, when you are playing a role, seems a tremendous threat. What's going to become of me? But they explained that that doesn't matter. You would just have to find out when you are ready to die. You can die properly and with dignity if you know who you really are. So in order to find out who you really are, you withdraw from your role. And you become what is called vanaprastha, which means forest dweller, instead of grihastha, which is householder. In other words, you go back to the forests, away from the polis, outside the pale. The doing of this may take many forms. It may be purely perfunctory, that you retire to a cottage in the backyard. You may actually go out into the jungle. You may actually tear off all your clothes and run naked and sit by the river. All sorts of ways of doing it. But you give up your name. You become nameless. Or you may assume a name which is a divine name, one of the names of God. There are people trying to do this in the United States today called hippies. I met one the other night and I asked him what his name was, and he said, my name is you. And he absolutely would not acknowledge any other name at all. Great. Okay. You're you. So, when you become vanaprastha, you're outside the pale, and you concentrate your psychic energy to find out what's going on. What is this that we call existence? You can find this out quite easily, but you have to pay attention to it. You have to concentrate. You have to give your whole mind to, say, take hold of a sound and find out what sound really is. Or you can look at light and find out what light really is. Or you can touch something and find out what is going on here. And when you find out, you stop being anxious. But you see then, politics is the order of that transitory state, which is the city arrangement, the role-playing, the game of social life, designed in a particular style. Now, I'm not trying to say in any way that the polis is something wrong. We shouldn't put it down and say it's bad. The only thing that could be bad is to take it too seriously. In other words, if you take the fundamental idea that the whole universe, all its forms, all the forms of biology, all the different species, the giraffes, the rhinoceroses, the baboons, the roses, the eucalyptus trees, etc., everything, is a form of biological game. It's a dancing thing going on, different styles. And we wouldn't want to say to any of those things, you shouldn't happen. Because they are all the great Maya, the great illusion, the great play. And so the polis, the human community, organized with division of labor, with classes, with all the complications of economics and banking and transportation and so on and so on and so on. All this is a particular kind of play. And each form of it is as legitimate as, say, different kinds of dancing, a waltz, a rumba, a foxtrot, a frug, all are perfectly legitimate forms of dancing. So the universe does this. But the important thing to understand, and what the sannyasin, the shramana, the man who goes outside the pale, is saying is, please, people who are in the pale, my existence reminds you that you're only playing. Don't take it too seriously. Because if you take it too seriously, you're going to start destroying each other and fighting and saying, this city against that city, this country against that country, so on, because you're too involved. So every sane society allows a certain number of people to deviate. Monks, some sort of outsiders. It says you don't have to join, you don't have to play the game. A society which is insane and unsure of itself cannot allow that to happen. It says everybody must join, everybody must work, everybody must belong. And then freedom disappears. Because as a matter of fact, the anxiety is, if you say, well, you don't have to join, there are conditions under which you can go out, then a lot of people get together and say, well, what would happen if everybody quit? I ask, what would happen if everybody decided to take American Airlines Flight 3 to New York tomorrow? Well, they just wouldn't get on. I mean, and they won't anyhow. Because a lot of people aren't interested in that, are not ready to quit. That doesn't mean that they're inferior. The acorn is not inferior to the oak tree. It's a potential oak, but as an acorn, it's just as beautiful and lovely a thing as a full-grown oak is. A baby is as lovely as an adult, sometimes a great deal more lovely. So a person who is in a beginning state of evolution is just as marvelous as a person in a high state of evolution, just as much a manifestation of the divine dance. So, when a society allows a certain number of people to withdraw, it should have no anxiety that everybody will want to withdraw. Because some people are absolutely fascinated in competition, in being involved, in playing the game. They should be. It's fine for them. But we are witnessing in the United States today a great motivation for withdrawal. It's simply because we haven't provided for it. We haven't, there's no opportunity for a Protestant to become a monk, or a Jew. The Catholics have half-heartedly provided for this sort of thing. And there have to be people who stand outside the game and do not identify themselves with a class, with a name, with an ego, with a persona, with a role. And a society which cannot tolerate that is weak and in grave danger. of dissolution. A society which can tolerate it is sure of itself inside. Doesn't have to insist on everybody agreeing with the way you see things. That's the nature of democracy, to say, you have a right to differ. And so, furthermore, underlying the nature of a democracy is the notion of mutual trust. And this is difficult in a polis. You can't obviously have an ongoing human arrangement in which proper behavior between each other is enforced by violence of some kind, by police. Well, after all, who stands behind the police? Who gives the police their authority? Why, the people do. But if the authority of the police becomes something separate from the authority of the people, you get a violent situation. You no longer have democracy, you have a dictatorship. So, but if you really trust each other, you don't really need much in the way of police. Yes, you need some scouts to direct the traffic, who simply establish which row is to move first, not by authority, but simply pointing out that when we get to a crossroads, there has to be some sort of order here. And we let so many cars go through this way, then we stop them and we let so many cars go through that way. And that's for the mutual benefit of everybody concerned. So there's a scout there to give a signal, which we've all agreed upon. But when that scout starts dressing up like a stormtrooper and putting on all kinds of guns and whistles and helmets and things like that, then he begins to act his role. He begins to behave like that kind of a person. And he becomes a vested interest. And so we have to say to him, go back to your Boy Scouts hat. Take off that helmet. On those bandoliers full of bullets and those boots. Start looking like a human being again. And then you'll behave like one. And everybody will respect you, and when you put up your hand and say, this row, please, and then everybody will, of course, naturally accommodate themselves. So, as then a society tolerates within itself a group of people who play no role, who are in that sense liberated, we come to see, all of us, that the political game is not absolutely serious. That the laws of the state are not the laws of nature. That the laws, what we even call the laws of nature, are very many of them nothing but social institutions, like time, like space, and so on. And so in not taking our civic, political life too seriously, we can live it at a decent pace and stop from the idea that it is our sacred duty to impose our wonderful way of life on everybody else. And that, you see, is a quality of humor. When you don't take yourself too seriously, you can laugh at yourself. And this is the most essential ingredient for a politically healthy people is to be able to laugh at themselves. That's why one of the difficulties about churches and law courts. I was in a law court some time ago giving evidence, and the two accused people were smiling, and the judge hit the gavel. He said, you two young gentlemen should realize that you're on trial for a very serious crime, and that this attitude of laughter is disrespectful to the court. And their attorney got up and said, Your Honor, this is the first time these two men have ever been in court, and they don't understand what the rules are. Well, he said, it's high time they did. Now, every great court where a supreme king, Chakravartin, presides, always provides for a jester to be present. Because the moment the king in charge, or the justice, becomes too serious and takes himself too seriously, there is tyranny abroad. And so a proper king has sitting right down there on his left a character in Cap and Bells, the fool. And in ancient days, the fools were very powerful people. Very important people. One of the fools of the court of England, Rahere, founded St. Bartholomew's Hospital out of his wealth. Because the fool, as Shakespeare puts it, within the hollow crown that rounds the mortal temples of a king, keeps death his court. And there the antic is an old word for the fool, and there the antic sits, scoffing at his state and grinning at his pomp, allowing him a little time to monarchize, be feared, and kill with looks. And then at last comes death, and with a little pin bores through his castle walls. And farewell, king. Because the fool is the one who reminds you all the time that you're mortal. You're fallible. You're human. Don't take yourself too seriously. So, at the Congress of the United States, at the sessions of the Supreme Court, there ought always to be a fool who says to the judges, but you know, the trouble with republics is that they are a little insecure and they don't allow fools around. Very secure kings only can allow fools. Dictators can't allow fools because they rest upon the will of the majority. They get into power through referendums. They sure can't tolerate fools around. It's only an aristocrat, a person who has come from a long, long line of rulers and isn't insecure about the situation. He can allow the fool. So if a people is to be mature, a democracy is to be mature, it must allow the fool. It must allow the joker. And not merely as a cartoonist in the daily press to point fun at the goings-on of the presidency, but somebody actually present at cabinet meetings who is appointed to be the maverick, to be the funny man of the whole session. In the same way, a university faculty must have in its membership a small percentage of complete screwballs who are not respectable scholars, who have weird ideas, because they will keep the rest of the faculty alive. Not too many of them, always a little balanced, like the salt in the stew, a little bit, but not too much. That is always the element of the people who say to the whole system that's going on, to the whole reality of life, ha ha.